Welcome to Charlotte Readers Podcast, where books and writing topics are center stage and where authors give voice to the written words. I'm Landis Wade, and on behalf of my co-host, Hannah LaRue and Sarah Archer, we thank you for listening.
The Charlotte Readers Podcast is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. Listen to your city at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
Hey, readers and writers, welcome to this episode number 381 of Charlotte's podcast, Beyond 300. I'm here with co-host Sarah Archer. We've got a great show for you today.
Yeah, we sure do. This one is a little bit different. Today, our guests are two literary agents, Christina Sutton Ledden and Jamie Chambliss, who are going to discuss the business of being a literary agent. So listen up, writers. We're going to pull back the curtain on the mystique of working with agents. We'll also talk with Christina and Jamie about how they work, such as what they look for in clients, how they secure book deals, their thoughts on the current state of publishing, and more.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this discussion. A little bit about our guests, who we met at the North Carolina Writers Network Conference last fall in November. Jamie Chambliss is an agent with Folio Literary Management, where her clients include Laura Prescott, Lauren Huff, Tom Vitale, and Rachel Rogers. She previously worked in editorial and marketing at Algonquin Books in Chapel Hill and as a magazine journalist. And Christina Sutton Ledden is the CEO and co-founder of Focused Artist, where she represents both authors and screenwriters. Christina also has a background as an actor, an educator, and previously served as a film and TV agent for a talent agency in Atlanta. In 2022, Publishers Weekly named her a Star Watch honoree. Christina and Jamie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, I guess I need to know, what is a Star Watch honoree, Christina?
So essentially, it's where Publishers Weekly has a list of kind of like rising stars in the publishing industry. They come out with that list annually. They just came out with a round for 2023. It's exciting to see that list. And I was part of last year's class.
That's awesome.
That's amazing.
Look,
yeah,
hey, that makes the headline for this episode that much better. How about that? and Jamie, Algonquin Books, is that the old Algonquin? I mean, that's been around for a long time.
It is. Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill.
Yeah. Okay, yes. Good. Well, great. We're happy to have you all on the show. We're going to start here with your backgrounds. And the first question is, how and why does someone become a literary agent? So we'll start with Christina. How and why did you become a literary agent?
How and why did I become a literary agent? Kind of the thread of my entire career has been storytelling, and it all happened very organically. I mean, I was always that kid that loved to read. And for me, actually, I was that kid that also didn't like to break the binding on the books. You know, like I would kind of peek into the books. I didn't want to break the binding. I was really super careful with my books. I just loved them so much. I have had a career as an actor, really loved photography as well. And essentially all of that is storytelling, right? So, you know, for me, it's just a matter of what lens I was telling the story through. So with the literary agency, it's really just an organic extension of everything else that I've been doing. Whether it was telling a story on screen or on the page. And I love to be able to advocate for others and to be able to help tell their stories. And this was the best way to do it, is to be an advocate for the artist. And, you know, being a literary agent is such that you can help amplify voices that you, really want to have out there. And then also learn so much. You know, it's like a wonderful history lesson. I feel like with every query or with every book that I'm reading, I'm stepping back into time, into history, learning something about another culture. So it's also a very educational experience. And that's what I really enjoy about it as well, is not only am I helping others, but I'm also constantly learning myself.
That's great. We're going to come back to the how then. We'll just do the why first. Jamie, tell us why you, just like Christina.
Yeah. So I grew up like small town North Carolina. I didn't know that the book world was something that you could actually work in. I kind of thought they just arrived fully formed. And so I started out in journalism and, just looking for a way to be able to someone to pay me to write and be in the world of words. And, And then became more knowledgeable and learned that people actually put these books together. They do make the books. And so I started out at Algonquin Books when I made my shift from journalism to book publishing, and learned while I was at Algonquin, learned more about what literary agents do. And I felt like that you have a little bit more control over the type of projects that you can go after. And that was really appealing to me, and just an opportunity kind of came up to work at Folio, and I could do it remotely. I'm not based in New York, and that was really appealing as well. And then in sort of a less practical way, again, just being able to, like Christina said, being able to champion people who haven't always had a voice, and stories that aren't out there yet, and being able to have a hand in helping those stories get out into the world was just really, really exciting and really appealing.
Oh, that's great. And then before Sarah dives deeper in this background piece here, I want to get back to the how, because being a lawyer for many years, I'm curious, this may sound like a stupid question. Is there any kind of a licensing agency? Is there any kind of test you got to take? Is there any kind of training that's mandatorily required for somebody to be a literary agent? How do you, what are the steps to becoming a literary agent? Who wants to take that? Either one.
I mean, I don't think there is a, there's any kind of licensure. Right. It's probably very helpful to have some legal background, right, actually. But it's really, you know, I think being a book lover is probably the most, you know, the biggest requirement. It's a job that requires you to be able to wear a lot of hats. It's not just about, you know, the reading process. It's engaging with people on both sides of the publishing dynamic, the editor side, the publishing house side, but also, you know, working with writers. And I think in publishing in this day and age, having agents tend to have more, be more involved in the editorial shaping than maybe they used to be. So having those skills, one of the things about literary agenting, especially in the post-pandemic time, is that it isn't so New York centric. And I think that can only be great for publishing, because it provides, you know, people who have all different perspectives that are outside of New York, which I think is helpful. So I myself just sort of stumbled into it and got lucky in that I was able to do it and not be in based in New York. So the how was sort of right time, right place, I think. Not sure how much that answered your question, Christina.
Yeah, and I just kind of wanted to chime in too on what, you know, Jamie had said, that I also am appreciative of the fact that the publishing industry has grown in such a way that it's not so, you know, New York centric, because I feel like that can be very limiting to the kinds of voices out there. And then also too, in terms of accessibility, I like that it's now more inclusive. And, you know, that's something that I think that we can always improve upon. And then in terms of how one becomes a literary agent, I would say that it's very much an apprentice based business. And so, you know, it's really about, you know, putting yourself out there, asking questions, being willing to learn. And, you know, a lot of people will start out with internships, you know, some will start in an adjacent business. For example, myself, I was in film and TV as a film and TV agent. And so a lot of those are transferable skills, you know, from being a film and TV agent to a literary agent. In terms of just, you know, negotiations and pitching, all of those skills. And yeah, so I think having access to, you know, people that you can ask questions to, a mentor, all of that is very, very helpful to becoming a literary agent. Because again, it's very much an apprentice-based industry.
Yeah, it's interesting that you both have kind of varied backgrounds. Neither of you, you know, came out of college and went straight into the agency world. And you both have creative sides too. I mean, Jamie, you've done some writing with journalism. Christina, you've done acting. You also represent screenwriters and actors. Do you think that that flexibility is important these days, either for being an agent or for writers as well, like being able to work in different fields? Is that something that you kind of seek out for clients, and being able to kind of, you know, hybridize together a career as a creative person?
Yes, I would say that being able to pivot is extremely important, because you know, this world, you never know what it's going to throw at you. During the pandemic, we never knew what was coming next. And so, for example, the actors couldn't go to set. They couldn't go to the theater to perform. But those clients of mine, they were writing a lot. And some of them are multi-hyphenates. They had been writing anyway. And then, you know, this year, for example, there was also the actor strike and the writer strike. And so, you know, being able to pivot in a way that increases your, you know, ability to be able to make an income is really important and to monetize that creativity. So wearing multiple hats is important, I think, for writers. And I think that that's helped me in my career to be able to show them that I have had, you know, experience in whether it was photography or acting, being able to pivot and being able to say, hey, you know, if an opportunity comes your way, say yes. And then, you know, to go back to my improv days, in improv, you say yes and, right? And so I that's something I always encourage my clients to do, is to look at an opportunity that maybe they haven't thought of before and, you know, think about whether they're willing to say yes and what can they bring to that opportunity.
I like that way of thinking about it, yes and, as an approach to a writing career. I think that's really good.
Yeah, I love that too. I'm gonna incorporate that. I think that's just great as a way of life. I will add, you know, speaking from having some experience as a writer, and I was an editor in magazines before I shifted over to books, I think it helps to make me, I think, more understanding of the writing process and of what writers go through. I think it helps, I hope, make me more empathetic as I'm providing feedback and sort of understand that visceral way that feedback lands. I mean, obviously anybody who gets into a creative endeavor knows they need to have some degree of thick skin, but still when you're creative, you're being vulnerable. And when you're writing something and you're getting feedback, it's still, you know, you're vulnerable. And so I think having that sort of understanding from having been there myself, I hope it makes me a more empathetic editor when I'm wearing my editor hat. And also just understanding sort of the emotional side of putting your work out there to editors and putting, you know, for authors, putting their work out there, knowing that it may get rejected and helping authors navigate that part of the process. I think, you know, it can be very difficult. And, so I think having that writing experience does help me in that regard.
All right. This is great stuff. We've kind of promoted this as pulling back the curtain a little bit. And, you know, we've talked to authors about those who publish independently, those who publish with small presses, those who published with large presses and have agents that help them do it. We kind of want to talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts of being an agent, kind of what agents typically do, maybe what agents typically don't do. Christina, we can start with you. This is just kind of from your learning experience, it may not be everything that you do necessarily, but we're just kind of talking about what a literary agent does for an author. And then we're also going to kind of throw in what a literary agent typically does not do for an author. So Christina, you're up.
Sure. So the day is different, you know, each day is different, you know, even though a lot of the tasks can be the same. And I think that's what's really exciting about it. I never know what's going to be in my inbox. And sometimes it feels like Christmas morning. It's like, oh, this is a query that I've been looking for a project like this. This is super exciting. So the main thing that we do is, you know, shepherd along projects and, you know, to help them come into the publishing world. So that can start with, you know, just looking at your inbox to see, you know, what the queries that you can field to see, you know, if you want to see maybe an additional, you know, 10 pages, or if you want to request the full manuscript. The day is also filled with meetings with clients or with potentially editors, you know, reaching out to editors to kind of find out what's on their wish list and to also, you know, find out maybe what do they have upcoming or maybe what they're not seeing in their inbox so that we can kind of be scouting for them. The day is also filled with a lot of emails and writing emails. Project management, I think, is super important because at any given moment, an agent can have, you know, a project that's about to be published by one of their clients, something that is on submission. You know, another project is very much in the development stage where you're still maybe even line editing with that author. So, you know, various projects in different stages. And so every hour can be something different. And, you know, a lot of it too is research, you know, researching, you know, the what the deals are in Publishers Weekly and Publishers Marketplace to find out, you know, what there's an appetite for in the marketplace. And of course, finding time to read the manuscripts that your clients have sent you, the new edits, and or just reading for your own self so that you can stay, you know, informed of what's out there and also, you know, what you like.
Jamie, what about you? I think Christina's done a good job of talking about what a day in the life is kind of like. It sounds like a lot of emails, a lot of communications, a lot of checking on what, you know, the publishing world wants, if you believe they know what they want. In terms of, you know, kind of what you do for an author per se, it's kind of, I've heard, okay, you query, you maybe take the author on as a client, then you're going to try to find that book a place to land. Talk about that a little bit. What's that process like?
Sure. Well, backing up just a little bit, I think the way that the publishing landscape is now, I think a lot of agents do a lot more of the hands-on editorial work with their clients before they go into submission. So that can be somewhat prolonged, depending on the quality, you know, what shape a manuscript is in when it comes in. I do both fiction and nonfiction. So nonfiction is sold on proposal. So a lot of that work is done working with a client to develop that proposal, which is more of kind of a sales tool than just a manuscript. So there's a lot of that editorial work on the back end. And then the submissions process is a process of sort of looking at the editors that you know and looking and often consulting with your colleagues about the editors they know to try and compile a list of editors that you think might be interested in the manuscript, whether it's a fiction manuscript or a nonfiction proposal, and then compiling the submission materials. So you submit a letter. So I think a lot of agents have a lot of empathy for writers trying to do their query letter, because we're basically doing a query letter, but to editors. And so doing a submission letter and making sure the manuscript or the proposal is in the best shape that you want it to be in. And then submitting it to those editors. And then, you know, hopefully you've got interest from multiple editors and there are conversations, and the author will talk to the editors that are interested and talk about the book, and sort of, it's an opportunity for the author to hear the editor's vision for if they were to take this book on, sort of, this is what, how they see the book and what the audience that they see for the book. And then hopefully an offer comes in, and as an agent, we help authors navigate that offer process and weigh the feel that they got from the editor versus the reputation either of that editor or of that publishing house, and what that publisher is bringing to the table, what they're in terms of the marketing might that they're going to be able to put behind it, the vision they have for the type of publicity that they envision for the book, those kinds of things, and just sort of seeing what that team might look like, what your publishing team and what that fit is going to feel like, and then helping them. And a lot of times, you know, if an author is lucky enough to have multiple offers, it's not always the highest offer that they might go with. They want to, you know, ideally you want to go with the publisher with the editor that you feel like most gets what you're trying to do with your book, and with the publisher that you feel like they have this really strong sense of how they want to get your book out into the world. And then agents are there with their authors through the publication process, and that can be anywhere from 9 months to longer, depending on the type of book and where it lands on the publisher's list. So you're there with the author, and you're there as they get, for example, prospective covers, and you know, maybe it's not the cover that they had envisioned, and you work with them to sort of figure out, you know, kind of act as a liaison between the author and the editor about that cover, and maybe how we can nudge it a little bit more to what you wanted, or maybe, you know, you love it and that's awesome and everybody's happy. And then just making sure that the publisher has a marketing plan and a publicity plan, and that gets in action because the lead time for publications, they need to be mindful of that to make sure that they're getting books in reviewers' hands and bloggers' hands and wherever the book needs to be in order to get publicity for the book and, you know, timed with when the book comes out. And then once the book is out in the world, you know, most agents, they're not going to just vanish. They're going to be with the author for that process. And hopefully, you know, hopefully the book has a, makes a big splash in the world. And then it's on to talking about the next book and doing it all again. And hopefully, I mean, you know, that's the dream, right? Is to have multiple books and have it not just be one book, but be a career. And so, you know, I think most agents see themselves as wanting to be there for the long haul with their clients.
God, it opens up. That's a lot of great information. Opens up a whole lot of questions. I'm not going to do them yet. Sarah, I'm going to let you jump in. Mm-hmm. And
Yeah. I mean, there's so much that you're doing for your clients and so many different balls you're keeping in the air. What are your sort of expectations or desires from the client side throughout that whole process? Obviously, the first step is write a good book and send it to you. But beyond that, what are maybe some things that a writer can do to help you help them and to do your job well for them?
So I would say for me, it's that attitude of collaboration, being willing to accept feedback, because I very much view working with an author as a partnership. So I'm only going to be able to make money if they make money, and I'm there to help them get their project published. So it only behooves both of us to really collaborate, to make the manuscript as strong as it can be, as dynamic as it can be, and, you know, be a winning yes whenever we send it to an editor, right? We want it to be very strong as possible when they make that full manuscript request. So what I look for, again, is collaboration. I would say flexibility and adaptability to, you know, not be too precious with their manuscript. Understand that the edits are not going to stop with me. They are going to have an editor, you know, and they might even have multiple editors at that publishing house. So, you know, having an attitude that is receptive to feedback is so important. And then another thing I look for too is just that work-life balance and that mutual respect. You know, for me, when my clients go on vacation, I really want them to go on vacation, you know, unless there's like a time-sensitive, you know, offer on the table that they need to know about. Like, I'm not going to want to contact them on their vacation. I really want them to live their life and really, you know, take that moment to take a breath and enjoy life. And I look for that same thing in my clients, you know, that, you know, a holiday or a vacation, that they are going to be respectful of that time, unless, again, it's something super time sensitive. And, you know, I think in this day and age too, we also have certain tools that enable that, right? So if you have a pressing question, now we have the ability to time our emails, right? So if you think of something at 5 a.m. or, you know, on Christmas Day or whatever it might be, you can always time that email to come out, you know, at a time where, you know, that other person is not going to feel like they have to answer right away. So I think that's a really useful tool that I like to use, is scheduling emails. So I would say, just to kind of wrap it up, adaptability and, you know, that work-life balance, that mutual respect, all of those things are super important when I'm working with authors.
Yeah, I would add to that communication. I think, you know, it's one of the conversations that I have at the outset when I'm talking to new potential clients, is what their communication preferences are, how they like to work. And then just, I can, the more I know, the more I can help you as an author. So for instance, authors who then, once they start working with their editor, if they keep me in the loop, like, I don't want to micromanage, but just being aware of what's going on, then if something comes up, I'm able to sort of step in and sort of help them navigate. If there's, you know, say an editor has an editorial suggestion that the author doesn't want to make, that I think that's part of the role of the agent, is to sort of help them navigate that. So open communication, I think, is important. Another thing I think for authors is to go into their author agent dynamic having, in an ideal world, having a balance between trusting their agent's expertise and listening and giving credence to that, but also advocating for themselves. Agents, when we're doing the editorial process, you know, we're doing our best to say, this doesn't quite sound right to my ear, or this character maybe feels a little extraneous. And sometimes that's advice that authors should listen to. And other times authors need to advocate for themselves and say, no, that character is in there for X reason. And, you know, I hear what you're saying, and maybe I need to tweak here, but I want this character to stay. I think it's finding, not being stubborn about things, you know, because agents and editors do have that expertise. They've been doing this for a long time, but also not completely bending to every suggestion, because, you know, knowing your own work, knowing your vision, knowing what you're trying to do with your work is important as well. So I would say having that ability to sort of strike that balance is good.
That's a great point, Jamie. Yeah, to your point, I absolutely agree. And I think because that process gets harder, you know, when it's an editor, you know, asking for those changes. So upfront, you know, knowing what elements the author doesn't want to budge on and having those principles intact, I think that's really important to know early on, because, you know, when changes start being asked by the publisher, it might be harder to say no at that point. So yeah, absolutely being able to advocate for yourself and knowing what you're willing to budge on or not.
We're going to talk about publishing contracts in just a moment, but before we do that, y'all are in business. You have contracts, I'm sure, with the clients that you work with. Do you have any advice for people who are getting ready to sign with a literary agent as to what they should be looking for in the contract? Do you have certain things that help, you know, keep things on track and don't have people have certain misconceptions about, you know, what the legal obligations are and the time commitments are? We can, Christina, we'll start with you.
Sure. And do you mean contracts in terms of signing with agents or contracts in terms of signing with publishers?
First, we're going to do agents. And after we do that, we're going to talk about publishers. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, absolutely. There shouldn't be any kind of upfront fees with an agent. Again, they're only going to, they work off commission, so they're only going to make money if the book sells. So that's the first red flag to look for. Other things to just be aware of are, you know, I would say looking for expectations. Make sure that those expectations are laid out, not only of the author, but what are the expectations about the agent? You know, is that in the contract? You know, what should you expect from your agent? You know, what kind of relationship on paper is included in the contract? I think that's really important to lay out so that everybody has clear communication, clear expectations, and, you know, there isn't confusion later down the road. And then I would say for publishing contracts, certain things to look at would be, you know, rights, like world English rights versus North American rights. If you feel like your book is potentially of interest in other languages, you know, to have translation rights, I would say, you know, be conscious of that when you're, you know, looking at the deal that's offered to you. You know, perhaps you want to hang on to rights for other languages, right, as opposed to just giving away all the rights. One thing that I would say too is really look at media rights, you know, not just film and TV rights, but also, you know, audio rights, your live stage rights. You know, a lot of times books will be turned into musicals or, you know, maybe a podcast. So yeah, looking at the media rights is super important, and all of those things your agent can help you navigate.
Yeah, to the contracts with an agent or agency, I would add being mindful of, being aware of what the contract language is for if both parties decide to, if you decide to part ways, and just knowing, usually it's not complicated at all. It's maybe just saying in writing. But I think just being mindful and making sure that as an author, you know what that language is, and that you're comfortable with it. And for publishing contracts, I mean, I totally agree with Christina about the translation rights and being mindful of the media rights. You know, in an ideal world, you're having these conversations with your agent before anything is signed, and you're, you know, a lot of this comes up in the offer stage, and can be discussed and sometimes negotiated in that stage. But yeah, those are all really good things to be mindful of.
Before I kick it back to Sarah, since I'm this recovering trial lawyer here, and I want to ask all these legal questions about contracts, I think it's interesting. Authors are needy people, right? We want things to happen right away. So timelines. Can you talk about timelines and whether those kind of things are in the contracts? And then the other question I have is, how much negotiating ability do you have with some of these provisions? Because I know that the publishers got a big staff of lawyers. They're going to try to load up as much stuff in that publishing contract and take as much as they can take. So the one question is about timelines. The other is about ability to negotiate some of these terms. Christina?
Sure. So I'll take the negotiation question first. You might have to remind me on the timeline question.
Sure.
So I would say with the negotiations, it really depends on how badly they want the book, right? And also if there's multiple parties interested in the book. So I'm always going to want to empower my client and put them in a position where, they're not just taking a deal because it's the only deal offered to them, but, ideally we're putting them in a situation where they can choose the home that they want their manuscript to live, right? If they have multiple parties interested, then it's going to enable me to negotiate different factors. And you can actually, if you go to auction, that's something that you can really experiment with, right? If something goes to auction, then it's different tiers of that. So, and again, it may not even be the winning advance, right? The highest advance that is what the client chooses. They might be taking into consideration rights. They might be taking into consideration the marketing team, or maybe just how well they get along with the particular editor that's super interested in their project. So there's multiple factors that can allow a client to choose the winning party of an auction. But just making sure that, again, I empower my client as much as possible. So it really just varies how much you can negotiate, but I'm always going to try to keep as many rights as possible from my client so that, we can negotiate and navigate that with them over time. And then in terms of timeline, yeah, that's interesting. I would say most agent contracts are usually not more than about, 24 months. That's about, 2 years. And sometimes there is an option to, extend that. And that initial agreement, there's an option agreement to extend that initial term. And then with the publishing contracts, it's probably going to take 12 to 18 months for your book to come out once you actually, put ink to paper and sign it and the deal is done. It's going to probably take 12 to 18 months, sometimes longer. And with, for example, picture books, it can definitely be longer because if the book is not illustrated, they have to go and find the illustrator. So it might be several years before your book is actually out into the world. And then one thing to look at in terms of timelines with contracts too is maybe reversion of rights, I would say. So for example, if audio rights are available for the book and maybe they haven't released the audio book, perhaps there could be something in the contract that those audiobook rights revert back to the author should the audiobook not have come out in, maybe 36 months or something. So that could be one thing, too, to look at in terms of timeline is how long do they anticipate an audiobook release? And, that would give your agent time to shop it around if those rights were reverted back to the client.
I will add, as far as timeline in a more literal sense, that for authors, the contract process requires patience. It seems, especially in the last few years, it just seems, I'm sure that the poor contracts teams at publishers are as overworked as everyone else. And it just seems like the process of getting the contract the back and forth and all of that just takes time. And I think that is understandably very stress inducing for authors, because I think they are afraid that this dream is going to go poof in the, or somebody's going to change their mind, and that doesn't happen. But it does take patience, because that process is always more prolonged than I think anybody wants it to be. So going into it, knowing that it's going to take a little while, may take some of that anxiety out of it, and the deal's not going to go away. It's stuff's being hammered out in the back room, but it's all good. And as far as the negotiations, some agencies have their own in-house contract teams, which can help too. Those are people who probably do have a law background like you do. And that can help with some of that negotiating power too. And also I will say, to Christina's point about being in a strong negotiating position, how badly the editor and the publisher want it, that goes back to that process, editorial process, before you've even submitted it, and trusting an agent's expertise, and also trusting your own vision, and just trying to be patient and get the work where it needs to be, because the stronger it is when it's sent out, the more that you're going to, more likely you are to have editors and more editors who want it. And that's going to put you in a stronger negotiating position when it does come time to come to the contract time.
Well, speaking of patience, Sarah has been very patient as I've been going through all these legal questions here, but I do think it's important that, you know, authors go into it thinking about the fine print and understanding that this doesn't happen overnight, that there has to be, that very word came to my mind, Jamie, as you're talking about it, because you got to find an agent, you got to work with an agent, you got to get it in a good shape, then you got to try to find a, you know, publisher and maybe an editor who wants to really push your book at that publisher, and then you got to work with them, and then you got to get on their schedule. So it is a long process. Maybe we can move now to the beginning of the process. Sarah, what do you think about this whole thing about finding good people like Jamie and Christina to work with?
Yeah, of course. So moving backwards a little bit, and like you said, Jamie, it all starts with a strong manuscript that you're going out with. But starting from that point, before you even get to the place where, you know, you're working with a client and you have an offer on the table and everyone's making this happy marriage between the writer and the publisher, how do you find clients in the first place? I know, Christina, you mentioned getting queries in your inbox. Do you both accept cold queries on a continuous basis? Are you also looking at referrals or meeting writers at conferences? Maybe Christina, you can kick it off, but kind of how do you find your clients?
Absolutely. So I think a great resource is Manuscript Wishlist. And so authors can go there to find out, you know, what I'm looking for. And that's online. And, you know, they can find out what the guidelines are for submitting to different agents. And that will be a big time saver for them, instead of, you know, like throwing spaghetti against the wall, hoping that an agent will want a full manuscript request. They can really target an agent that could potentially be a match for them. And so for me, that's a great tool, is those, you know, queries that I get in my inbox will be, you know, much more tailored towards what I'm looking for at that moment. So I don't always open to queries, though, because for me, I know how long it can take to hear from somebody. And I don't want people out there for, you know, a year and a half or whatever it might be waiting for me to respond. So, you know, so that I don't take so long to get back to them. I am definitely closed to queries. And you know, on my website, there's a section where people can subscribe so that they can find out when I'm open, or they can just check manuscript wish list. There's just different ways you can find out when somebody is open to accepting queries. But I definitely also look at Twitter, actually, or I guess formerly Twitter, X. I participated in, like Latinx Pitch, for example, different pitching parties online, so I can scout talent that way. And I also look at conferences. And so then I really enjoy the conferences too, because if there's such a great writing community at the conferences, it's always so inspiring to me to see the community at a writing conference, because a lot of those authors have known each other for a while, and they've really been helping each other and advocating for each other. And, you know, to see their manuscripts and how they grow and how they give each other feedback to really improve. That puts their manuscript already in a better position when it gets to my desk, because I know that they've gotten that kind of feedback from their peers and from, you know, other people in the writing community to help improve that manuscript. So they're usually in pretty good tip-top shape by the time they get to me from a conference.
Like Christina, I conferences for sure. I've been closed to submissions since the pandemic, and I anticipate going forward that I will periodically open back up and then close back to catch up. Because like Christina, I feel terrible when it takes a long time. But as you know, as we've been discussing, you hear all of the different hats that we wear just in trying to be good agents to our clients, and then trying to find the time to read submissions and respond quickly. The guilt, I feel terrible. And so sometimes I have to close just to catch up because I don't want to leave people hanging for a long time. I also seek out, I have sought out a lot of the folks that are clients of mine. I found them. Twitter X has in the past been a really good place to look for people, look for writers, because I feel like if you can be interesting or have a really compelling turn of phrase in a tweet or, you know, on Instagram or something like that, you're probably going to be a good writer too. And that, that line of thinking has led me to several of my clients. Referrals. I really am drawn to, I really like science and I really like history. So I will follow people in those subject areas, not necessarily writers, just because I'm interested in those things. And then often I will find, oh, that person is doing a really interesting thing. And you know, maybe there's a book there or something like that. So some of it is just following my own kind of weird, quirky interests, too. So, yeah, that's generally where I look.
Well, y'all realize that y'all are kind of like celebrities around authors. So I want to know how many times when you're in the elevator, you're at a cocktail party and some author finds out you're a literary agent, they go, let me tell you about my book. It does happen, right?
Not as much as you think, actually. Yeah, maybe people are just you know, kind and respecting boundaries. But okay. I don't know, Christina. Maybe you're a bigger celebrity than I am.
No, I would say it doesn't happen nearly as much as you would think. I mean, we do. I think, or at least this has happened to me, Jamie. I'm curious. I do get, you know, where someone's like, "Oh, my uncle's writing a book," or it's like, yeah, you know, "My cousin should write a book." That I've gotten that before.
Well, I just get, oh, you're a lawyer. I've got a question about, you know, criminal law. Well, I'm not a criminal lawyer. Mm-hmm. I can't help you. But yeah, that happens.
They want that free advice.
Yeah,
right.
But I can give you some advice. Yeah. Well, look, this is, you know, it sounds to me like you both enjoy your jobs quite a bit. And there's a lot of creativity built into what you do yourselves, you know, as literary agents. So maybe we talk a little bit about the creativity you use when you pitch books, because you are, in fact, trying to tell the story for your authors. Christina, you're the actor. We'll start with you. Would you put on your acting gear when you go pitch that book to the editor?
Former actor.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, the agent formerly known as an actor. I definitely use creativity in my pitches to the publishers. When I'm writing an editor, I'll also kind of vary how I do that. Sometimes I feel like the best way to pitch the book is through quoting the book itself. Mm. Sometimes if there's some gorgeous prose, I've even opened up my pitch letters with that before, something that's really a great hook. So yeah, I think just having that kind of creativity, and that's fun for me. That's really fun to think, how can I best, you know, give the whole feel for this book in this one letter? And honestly, that is something that I look for when, you know, clients are or potential clients are querying me, is I will look and say, oh my goodness, you know, they were able to really capture a certain essence in this letter alone. I can only imagine how great their manuscript must be, because it's so hard to pitch somebody. And so when they are really able to capture my attention in a letter and maybe even quote themselves, like a line from their book, that I really grasp onto that. So But yeah, that's probably one of my favorite parts of the job is just passing my excitement and passion for a book onto an editor and trying to find that champion that's also going to be super excited about that manuscript as well.
How about you, Jamie?
Yeah, that and trying to convey that passion and also sincerely, you know, that it's not just, I'm not just hyping this up. This is something, you know, that I really am excited about or really do feel strongly about. I also will sometimes, sometimes you just have that project that has spoken to your own heart. And I've had a couple of those where, you know, whatever the author's writing about, I have a similar something in my own life or, and sometimes I will, you know, I will use that as an opportunity to say, you know, this one's personal for me. This resonates with me. Maybe it will resonate with you, you know, and just sort of, you know, look for the places where that's a lot of what we read for, right? Is for how it resonates with us or how it connects to our own life or how it's going to help us in our own life. So, and I might be speaking as much from, a nonfiction standpoint as fiction, but really looking for, how might this resonate with the editor that I'm pitching it to? How might this connect them and touch on something that they feel strongly about and trying to highlight those aspects as well.
That's great. Well, Sarah, we could probably keep this going, but before we get to our book recommendations today, Sarah, maybe we'll just kind of finish up with this sort of, you know, what does publishing want in the marketplace? Sarah, you want to kick a couple of those off and we'll wrap it up with that topic.
Yeah. So obviously you're looking for, you know, what attracts you to a manuscript too, but are you also thinking, or I'm sure you are, but how much are you thinking about what publishers want? Are you trying to capitalize on trends that you see? Do you think that's a losing battle? Do you have a sense of kind of what the marketplace wants or feel like publishers know strongly what they're looking to fill on their slate? How much of a role does that play versus just your response to the writing in the book?
I'm going to tell you when I saw that question, I left. I was like, I wish I knew, you know, but I mean, it's a great question. And I am constantly thinking, what does publishing want? What do readers want? What, you know, and it's also a little bit to a certain extent of a fool's errand because the publishing timeline is so protracted that, you know, you asked about trends. And if you try and, if what you're writing just happens to dovetail with what people are reading, awesome. But if it doesn't, trying to write to that is not likely to, it may be a source of more frustration than anything else because of how extended the publishing timeline is. It's just hard to catch that wave. Yeah, always mindful of trying to figure out what publishers want. I also have reached a point in my life where I have realized that I have to just follow my taste, and that's not always going to be aligned with what is selling really well. And I have to make my peace with that and just be true to what I as a reader like and what I am excited and want to spend multiple rounds of revisions. I'm a squeamish reader, so I'm not likely to read much horror. So I'm not likely to represent much horror, but I know lots of people love that. And it just isn't, I'm never going to sleep if I try to chase that one. So just trying to also be mindful of and being true to own interests. And fortunately, there are lots of fabulous agents out there who do love horror. And so I don't need to take it upon myself to try and cover that part of the publishing world.
Christina.
Yes, I definitely agree, Jamie. There's certain things. I don't represent horror either. I mean, I enjoy a gothic story and a little bit of mystery, but that's not a genre that, I'd have to sleep with the light on if I take on that genre myself. And then for me, I would say that what's really interesting about reading what's out there is it's kind of cool to see what ebbs and flows in terms of trends, you know what I mean? But I also tell my clients, don't ever write to a trend because the trend will be over by the time your book is out, you know? But what I do pay attention to in the marketplace is, you know, who are the editors greenlighting certain projects, because that's going to help me inform my submission list. So, in that regards, it's very important to me to be up to date on what's trending. Because if I happen to have something that's ready to submit, I want to find those editors who are going to be like yes about that project. So knowing which editors are really enthusiastic about certain genres or certain voices that they're looking for, that helps me with my submission process and pitching. And then for me, just as a mom, I have two young children. I look for books that are not on my kids' bookshelves or books that I wished had existed when I was growing up. So that, is definitely something that is not necessarily trending, right? It's like, there is no data about this book because a book like this hasn't existed, or there's not enough of these kinds of books. So in that regard, I will really push for a book if I feel like, I will die on that hill. You know what I mean? If I feel like it needs to be, hopefully I won't have to, but yes, I will definitely be an advocate for something that I really believe in that I just think needs to be out into the world and that isn't yet.
Well, just a quick follow-up to this. There's been a lot of change in the last 20 years in the publishing industry. Independent publishing took off, then ebooks came along, then audiobooks really picked up. AI is entering the world and people are trying to figure out, what to do with that. The structure of publishing is changing a little bit. They're narrowing some of the big publishers. Some traditionally published authors are jumping to do some indie work. Some are staying hybrid. They're doing some traditional, some indie. Y'all have to prepare for these changes. Are y'all kind of trying to look into your crystal ball and figure out what you've got to think about, what you're willing to think about doing to change your process? What's coming? Any predictions here about where the publishing world is going in the next couple of years? Christina?
If only we knew, right, that crystal ball does not exist.
We had you on the show. We were going to get this answer. We're going to put it out there. We have two of you.
That's right.
We're going to hold you to it, too.
So we'll listen to it in 3 years, and everything I said doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. No, I'm definitely, keeping tabs on AI and, for example, since screenwriters are also on my roster, with the WGA strike, that was, some of the things that they were pushing for with that strike, that was something obviously very important to keep track of. And so, for authors, I think that's something to be aware of, as well is how can we protect, our IP and, protect the future of our clients' work and their voice, cause you hear these scary things about, you feed, a certain kind of project into whatever AI model, and then it's used for language learning. And then all of a sudden this technology can spit out a book that looks or sounds like it's been written by, XYZ author. So all of that stuff is very important. And I'm not tech savvy enough, don't have that crystal ball to really know where that's going, but it is something that I'm constantly reading about and, want to be informed about for my clients for sure.
Jamie, what does your crystal ball tell you about the publishing industry in the next couple of years?
My crystal ball came from the same place that Christina got hers, I think. It's kind of cloudy. Definitely trying to educate myself as far as AI and, as Christina said, what our role is in protecting our clients. I am right now choosing to hear the voices that are saying AI is a tool right now and not a replacement. I am choosing to believe that at least right now, you can't replace the human factor of, the voice, the personality, those sort of intangible things that make something really sing or that make something really, hit your heart. AI may prove me wrong, but for right now, I'm voting for people. So that's where I am right now.
Well, that's great. And since we're all people here, there's no AI bots on this podcast today. Since we're all readers as well, we're going to do a few book recommendations before we wrap up today. And we will, Jamie and Christina, we're going to let y'all go first. Sarah and I have a book each to recommend, but, Jamie, do you have something you want to share with us? One or two?
I do. And I'm very happy that you asked this. One of my favorite books, and it's one that I have bought multiple copies and I can't keep it in my library because I give it out and then I buy another copy and then I give it out. But it's called The Last Days of Summer. It's somewhat old. I should have looked up to see when it first came out. The author is Steve Kluger, K-L-U-G-E-R. And it is just this beautiful, lovely story set right before the U.S. enters World War II. And it's epistolary, so it's told in letters, and it's mainly the point of view of this boy who is very precocious, very funny, a little bit troubled, and he starts writing letters to this pro baseball player who is like, dude, leave me alone, want nothing to do with you, kid. And yet they have this correspondence that is really, and this friendship that emerges that's really beautiful and lovely, and it's just such a, it hits my heart, and I love that book very much. And since you said we could do two, sure. I am going to also, because the timing is right, one of my clients, her debut novel called The Divorcees is coming out in March. And it is set in the 1950s in Nevada on a divorce ranch. And it deals with, I did not know there were divorce ranches, but before women had agency over whether or not they wanted to stay in marriages that were not working for them, Nevada saw a revenue stream in granting divorces after a 6-week residency. And these ranches sprung up for people to go live to establish that residency, and then they could get their divorce. And a lot of Hollywood stars used it, and there's a little bit of a heist in there, and it's very much about women on the verge of the kind of agency that is under threat in these times, which I didn't think we'd be going back there. And it's just really beautifully written, and I'm really excited for the author. Her name is Rowan Baird, B-E-A-I-R-D, and it comes out in March.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I was just reading an article, I think it was in the New York Times, about how the conservative element in the country is trying to go back and, in certain states, take back no-fault divorce. It was a way that, you know, no-fault divorce came about basically to protect women from being in sort of abusive relationships they couldn't get out of without having to prove the need for divorce. So, you know, if they have their way, which I hope they don't, but if they do, then maybe these divorce ranches will come back into play.
I hope they don't, but
yeah, I hope they don't, but hey, you can tie that into your marketing stream and talk about this with you.
Yes. Thank you.
That's a fascinating premise.
Yeah, it is. All right. Christina, what do you got for us?
So I'm definitely going to recommend my client's book that comes out in the spring as well. It is called In a League of Her Own, Celebrating Female Firsts in Sports. So this book is by Bonnie Jo Laughlin, who is actually the first and only female NBA talent scout. And so she really interviews these amazing women in sports, Billie Jean King, Jackie Joyner Kersee. I don't want to give away too many surprises, or some cool cameos in there and surprises. But you know, Danica Patrick. And what's really interesting too about this book is that it's not just athletes. And this is what I really love about what Bonnie Jill did, is it's for everyone. So if you love sports history, if you love sports, it's great. But also if you are, you know, wanting to know about what kind of career or job can you have in sports, like if you're not an athlete, if you're just a fan of sports but you have no idea what kind of career you can have, you know, she also highlights sports announcers, coaches, agents, lawyers, so lots of different professions in this book. And it's really about how do you overcome certain obstacles. It's not a salacious book or an expose or anything. It's very much an empowering book. And it's also, I think, a great book for those who just maybe are at a standstill or have plateaued in their own career. And some of the sage advice from these women can really, I think, be implemented into other industries as well. It's like, how do you overcome this obstacle, or how do you get to that next step? You know, how do you really excel in your own field? So definitely recommend that book. Scheduled to come out February 20th. And I'm going to be a rule breaker and actually mention a couple of books. I'm mentioning a book right now too, that's on my TBR list, my to be read list. I have started Shark Heart and I have loved it. So it's a book that I am very adamant about finishing over the holidays. I'm very excited about finishing that book. So Shark Heart, A Love Story. And that one is by Emily Habeck, I think is how you say her last name. And then a book I recommend is Lessons in Chemistry, if you haven't read it. There is a certain chapter in there that I don't want to give away that has a very interesting POV. And when I read it, I was like, that is brilliant. So that's all I'm going to say about Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmuth.
Yeah, well, thanks for that. I love, so for your client's book, In a League of Her Own, the first thing I thought of was League of Their Own, which was the great softball movie back in the 19... The women's softball league that Tom Hanks was in the big movie. Great. Hopefully you can piggyback on that a little bit to get some exposure there. No, that's a great fit. And
there's no crying in baseball.
Yeah, there's no crying.
That classic.
Right.
No crying in baseball. But yeah, okay. Well, thanks for that. Sarah, what you got?
Well, first of all, I want to read all of those. Shark Heart, especially, is such a great title. That's very intriguing. So I'm recommending something that is not at all a new or timely release, but this is what I've been reading this week, and I stand by it, and it's a good book, and people should read it. It's called Louisa May Alcott, An Intimate Anthology, and it was put out by the New York Public Library, I believe. They compiled it. And I yesterday was on a different podcast and radio show called Fika with Vicky to talk about Louisa May Alcott. So this has been my most recent read over the week, and this gets into, obviously she's most known for Little Women, but a lot of people don't really know much of Alcott's other work and much about her life. And she was such a varied writer. I mean, in addition to her kind of more moral, wholesome stories that she's known for that she did later in her life, she wrote steamy, lurid potboilers, she wrote psychological dramas, she wrote satire, she wrote poetry, she wrote very heartfelt essays. So much variety in her work. And she was also just a really interesting person, connected with a lot of major philosophers of the day and had some very progressive viewpoints for the time. Her family background was very kind of all over the place, but they were an interesting bunch. And so this book has some some biographical information about her. It has some selections from her essays and journals. And it also has a bunch of her writings too. Like there's Hospital Sketches, which was a fictionalized account of her time as a Civil War nurse. There's a great story called Transcendental Wild Oats, which was based on this sort of failed vegan commune that her family was a part of when she was a kid. Her father was a philosopher, and it was basically a bunch of philosophers trying to farm in a New England winter and not knowing how to do that. So it's kind of a satirical take on that. And yeah, it's a really fascinating collection. I think she, in terms of her writing and just looking at her as a person and how she led her life and how she approached her writing career and kind of the connection between her creative side and her practical side, there are a lot of takeaways there, I think, for writers today as well. So yeah, her work, if you have only ever read Little Women, it's definitely worth digging into her oeuvre further.
Yeah, that's great. All right, well, I've got one. I've been listening to this book on Libro.fm. It's an audiobook. It's called The Frozen River by Ariel, I think it's Lawhon, L-A-W-H-O-N. This is a fascinating book. I told my wife she's going to love it because it's about the protagonist is a woman. It's 1789. It's in Maine. It's, of course, Frozen River. It's cold up there. And she is a midwife, and she's been a midwife for some 35, 40 years. And she writes this book about being in the small town. Starts with a murder, a little bit of a murder mystery, but it's really also about her having to deal, given her position as a midwife, with the male-dominated culture and the period in which women, there was a time of coverture, they could only testify if their husband was in the room, you know, all these different crazy things. But it is a mystery. I enjoy mysteries, love writing, love reading them. But more than that, this is a story about one woman's sort of struggle to explain what happened to this body that was found in the river, also to deliver babies as she's done for 35 years in the face of young 24-year-old men who come to the town telling everybody they're Harvard educated and they know better than she does how to deliver a baby. I told my wife this and she commented, yeah, when men started taking over delivering babies, that's when things went south. In any event, if you like this sort of being in the head of someone who really knows what they're doing in terms of the time period and also being a woman in that time period, it's really great. And the other thing I'd add as a writer that I really enjoy that I listen closely to is She's writing it in present tense, which adds a certain immediacy to the book, which I've not tried before, but she also slips into past tense when the time is needed. And it just adds a nice bit of tension to the manuscript as you're listening for it to be right there. Everything's in front of her. It didn't happen even a few seconds ago as you're reading, you know, the past tense, but it's right there in front of you. So Frozen River, I think it's getting some good vibes out there, and the audiobook's great, so I'd recommend that. All right, Sarah, you want to tell everybody what's coming next in March?
Yeah, sure. So we're kicking things off on a great note here with Christina and Jamie. And next time we're going to have award-winning author Joe Clifford, who's going to discuss his new psychological thriller, All Who Wander. Clifford's work has been praised as taut, pacey, and with a powerful sense of pace by celebrated mystery writer Paula Hawkins. Anthony-nominated author E.A. Amen calls his latest gritty, compelling, and fearless, a powerful read. So we're going to hear more about Joe's backstory and explore the themes in All Who Wander. Then coming up on March 19th, we feature award-winning author Mark Stevens and his novel The Fireballer, which is a poignant story about hopes, dreams, and how far one man's talents take him before he realizes it's about what you do and how you do it. This was named one of the best baseball books of the year in 2023 by Spitball, which is the baseball literary magazine. I didn't realize that was a genre, but I like that. The Denver Post calls The Fireballer a first-rate novel, an ode to baseball, and New York Times novelist Stephen Singular says, Mark Stevens has invented a startling what-if that stretches the limits of the game. Then coming up at the end of March, March 26th, we've got an episode with your three co-hosts, me and Landis and Hannah, sharing a wealth of writing advice from writers interviewed in the first 4 years of the podcast with some favorite quotes and takeaways from all 8 books in the Write Quote series, which we released over the course of this year, 2023. And we're going to cover a variety of topics from finding inspiration and writing techniques to publishing and marketing your finished book. Lots of great little nuggets of information in there. So writers, be sure to tune in for that one as well.
Yeah. And before we head out here today, Christina, thank you for being on the podcast and sharing your experiences and expertise with us.
Thank you so much, Sarah and Landis. And Jamie, it's always a pleasure to be in your presence as well. So this was so much fun.
And Jamie, thank you for being a part of this discussion today and sharing your knowledge and experience.
Thank you for having me, both of you and Christina. I feel like I learn something every time from you, so thank you.
Great to see you all.
Hey, folks, as we wrap up another episode, we just want to say thank you for listening. We appreciate you being here, and we hope you enjoyed the show. We also hope you'll join our community. To do that, feel free to poke around our website, charlottereaderspodcast.com. The best way to stay in touch is to sign up for our twice monthly newsletter, and you can do that via the contact page on the website. We won't spam you. That takes way too much time. We're not going to do that. You can also use our website to read our community blog and show notes, submit an elevator pitch to be played on the show, submit a blog post, give us feedback, submit to be on the show, become a Patreon supporter, and to see what's coming up on the show next, order our podcast books, or listen to previous episodes. So many things, and the best part, it's all free. Until the next episode, this is Hannah LaRue, and on behalf of Sarah Archer and Landis Wade, read on, write on, and rock on.